Hello and welcome back to Meet the Author series, brought to you by Graphic Publishing. I'm Kieran Minetta-Jones, and today I'm joined by Diane Barker, who's the photographer and author of the book Portraits of Tibet. We'll talk all about her experiences in Tibet and photographing Tibetan nomads. How are you, Diane?
I'm very good, thank you.
It's a pleasure to have you on the podcast. You've obviously written and compiled the book Portraits of Tibet, which I'm very fascinated to talk about. First of all, where did the idea of this book come from?
Oh, gosh, that's a good question. Because I became very passionate about recording nomads, I could see a way of life that was, a beautiful earth-based culture that seemed to be disappearing in front of my eyes. So my motivation for creating a book was partly for the nomads themselves, because I'd fallen in love with them and I wanted to make a record for them. And I also wanted to share the value of their extraordinary culture with other people and inspire people about their lives.
Brilliant. Just for the sake of anyone who may not be aware, because I know it's mentioned a lot and we may talk about it a lot, what does nomad mean?
Oh, my goodness. Well, in Tibet, they're nomadic pastoralists. So traditionally, they would move herds of yak and drew are the female of the species, goats and sheep from pasture to pasture, depending on the seasons. So it was very, nomad life is usually, it's very sensitive to the earth and the weather and also the sacredness of the land. At least that's the case very much with Tibetan nomads.
Very nice.
So they're pastoralists and they live in tents for most of the year, or they did traditionally.
So do they move around to find like appropriate grazing land and vegetation, or is it more to do with them just being comfortable?
It's to do with finding appropriate land, and it's guided by the time of year. So in the spring and summer, they start to climb up in altitude to the spring and then the summer pastures, which are very sort of verdant and full of flowers. And then as the weather changes and you come into autumn, they start to move down in altitude again, and they tend to spend the winter in more sheltered areas where the animals stay very, very close to wherever they're living. That if it's a settled house, they will keep them near the house.
Nice. And they're a very self-sustained society then?
Yes, very much so. They're self-sufficient. And because they move around, they don't have a lot of stuff, unlike us. I mean, look at my room, it's full of stuff. I wouldn't last 5 minutes.
None of them have cabinets of china then, do
they? No, they don't. No, it's rather ironic because I've got a house that's quite cluttered and I live a very different life, but I'm very compelled by them and their life and the fact that they don't want a lot. So traditionally, they lived in a kind of symbiosis with the farmers in the valleys, and they had a kind of barter economy. It wasn't a cash or a market economy.
So that trading goods and services?
Yeah, they would trade kind of dairy products, you know, drew milk and butter and cheese and yak meat with the farmers in return for things like barley, which is the real Tibetan staple. So the farmers would be growing barley. The farmers also have animals, but they don't move them around in quite the same way.
What would they use barley for then?
Well, barley grows very well in Tibet because of the altitude. It's one of the few things that does grow really well up there. And what they do is they take the barley, they roast it, and then they grind it. And the Tibetan staple food is called sampa. They eat it all day round. It's the sort of stuff they carry around with them when they're travelling as well. And you mix it with butter and butter tea, and then you can eat it either by, I'm not sure how to explain it, but you kind of knead it. So it's a bit like eating a sort of barley uncooked pastry, or you let the tea, the butter tea, float on top and you kind of, you lick it through the tea. Which means you get flour all over your face. So that tends to be the way I try to do it.
Wow.
And then also they put barley in tea as well as butter. You can have
barley tea.
But they put it a lot in things like tukpa, which is kind of soup. And they use it for making the noodles that go in the soup.
Nice. Are they? Would you say they're good cooks then? Is it quite limited, I guess?
I guess in a way Tibetan food is quite limited, but I find it delicious. Really, I do. I really find it delicious. People go on about, buttered tea, it's always rancid. I think that's tourists who go to sort of guest houses somewhere quite far from a nomad encampment where the butter isn't fresh.
Yeah.
But I really like butter tea. It comes into its own at altitude.
How would you describe it?
It's a bit like soup.
Hmm.
And because it's very high and dry in Tibet, I mean, they put a lot of salt in as well. It's very sustaining. I like the taste of it. And they make lots of other wonderful things like momos and shabalay and this lovely tukpa. And
I love the names.
It's really delicious. And I have some friends who have people want to try Tibetan food. I have some friends who have a cafe in Oxford called Taste Tibet.
Nice.
Yeshi, the cook, he does a lot of traditional Tibetan dishes, and then it's kind of fusion with some other food from India as well.
Is that something you could make at home if you wanted to, or is it quite specific to the way they make it?
Well, Yeshi's produced a cookbook, so he explains how to make it. I'm giving him a bit of a promo. He and his wife, Julie, have made a very nice cookbook so that you can find it in there. But he's made it very straightforward for people.
You then drank the nomads' foods, you drank their buttered tea, you enjoyed their travelling. What kind of led you to Tibet then?
It's a very, very long story, a very long story. I think initially, when I was a kid, I used to go and stay with my great auntie and she gave me a comic called The Swift. And in The Swift, they had in strip pictures, the story of Chief Crazy Horse of the Lakota. Now, I know that's very different, but in a way, there are a lot of similarities because the Native Americans came from Central Asia originally.
Yeah.
So I had a kind of feeling from a very, very young age about indigenous cultures that were close to the earth. I mean, I obviously didn't think about it like that then, but as I look back on my life, I can see a thread. And also when I was, so I traveled as a hippie in America, and I also came across Native American artifacts and beautiful photos of them in a museum in Phoenix. I was deeply inspired. And then back in England, the very first Tibetan I ever encountered was His Holiness the 16th Karmapa, who's a very, very remarkable and illustrious figure in Tibetan Buddhism. And he happened to come to visit some people near where I lived and gave a kind of ceremony. And the friends I had were Buddhists, and he was like a miracle, really. He gave a ceremony in a shrine room in their house to a small group of local hippies, one of which was me, and I only went out of curiosity. And I think he planted a seed in there.
Yeah.
And then years later, I came across Tibetans in India and was kind of fascinated by them and Indians, of course. So I was looking at both all the cultures in India. And I went to Ladakh, and in Ladakh, I came across some Tibetan nomads in a far northeast corner of Ladakh. I had wanted to photograph some nomads. I was asked by a publisher in Delhi. They didn't say whether it should be Ladakhi nomads or Tibetan nomads. I looked for nomads. I couldn't find them. The date for the publisher passed. You know, we overran the thing, but I sort of got the bit between my teeth and I was curious. And somebody set it up for me, and I ended up with a group of guys who knew where to find Tibetan nomads in Ladakh. And they were my first encounter, and it was a revelation. It was like it was one of those moments, you know, like a Road to Damascus experience. I mean, I was completely bowled over. And they reminded me very much of Native American Indians, but the culture was still alive with them. Whereas in America, I was very conscious of the fact I couldn't find a Native American culture I didn't come across it. And these Tibetans in Ladakh were so wild and so at one with their environment. I thought they were extraordinary, really extraordinary. I just fell completely in love with the whole group of them. And they had horses and they had long hair. They just were so welcoming. And so I spent a week with these people who'd taken me there, traveling around different nomad camps in that area. And I was so inspired by their culture, their closeness to the earth, their warmth and hospitality. I just felt strongly that I wanted to go and see nomads in Tibet itself.
Yeah, you kind of found them and they welcomed you. What was their welcome like? Did they have any like special things they do to welcome someone?
Not really. I mean, we all went in the tent that they had prepared. They were expecting this group that came.
Okay.
We all went in. They put me at the head of the tent, which I thought was curious, and then proceeded to give us all tea and things to eat. And then we went to their camp, and then they were very welcoming with me bringing my camera out, and they would invite me into their tents and share food with me, and they were just so friendly. And I couldn't speak any Tibetan.
Do they speak English at all?
No, one of the men who took me, he could speak English very well, and he was actually from one of these nomad families that we went to visit.
Nice. So yes. They're very welcoming, gave you loads of food and drinks.
Yeah.
Do they play like games or things like that? What do they do for like entertainment?
I wasn't aware of them playing games. That's something I've seen later in Tibet.
Yeah.
I didn't see any. I mean, they probably do a lot of, they play cards or something. That's what the men I went with were doing. Actually, the guys I went with weren't too happy to have me with them. They were hoping for a sort of men's getaway. And so it's part of why I fell in love with this whole very traditional group, because they seemed to not mind me being there, where I was very conscious that the guys that I'd been sent with were a bit, oh no, do we have to have her with us? They wanted to drink, you know, and play cards. But then I wasn't aware of the nomad group that we visited doing any of that. They were very, just being families together.
Interesting. But when you mentioned, was it like, there was Tibetan nomads and Ladakh nomads, or is that different?
They look a little bit different. I haven't met any Ladakhi nomads. All the ones I met were Tibetan.
Okay. So would they be very different, or generally would Ladakhi and Tibetan be similar anyway? Or are you not?
They are very similar. Ladakh, quite a long time ago, used to be part of Tibet. It was the most western part of Tibet, and I think the British annexed it. So their culture's very similar, and they're Buddhists like the Tibetans.
Yeah.
They practice the same Tibetan Buddhism, but the clothes are a little different.
Yeah, one thing I've always been interested in is, do they have zero technology? Do they have any technology at all past what they've had for generations and centuries?
In Tibet, they all have mobile phones. And now they have motorbikes. When I first went, they had horses, which I think was a lot of the kind of magic of it for me was this extraordinary horse culture.
Yeah.
And over time, it turned into a motorbike culture. and then some of them even have small kind of little Chinese vans or cars.
So they do have technology then. I kind of imagined that they lived off the land and didn't kind of consume any technology, but they have phones and cars now.
They have phones, yeah, and they have solar panels.
Oh, wow.
To create energy for light. So when I first went, the very first nomad camp I went to had a solar panel outside the tent, and they used it mainly to power up. They had a kind of ghetto blast. And so they light. I had a mixed tape. You can tell it was very old technology. It was the days of tape. I had a mixed tape of music for my Walkman that I then had, and they really liked it. And our host Chujal danced around the tent to the Water Boys. That was his favourite.
Brilliant. We've talked about how you became interested in Tibet and Tibetan people and nomads. So your book is a photography book, essentially the portraits of Tibet. So let's talk a bit about photography and your background. When did you kind of start getting into photography, and is that something you've always done?
Yes, I think since I was a teenager, my mum gave me one of those little point and shoot cameras.
Hmm.
I've forgotten what they're called now. An Instamatic.
I'm not sure what that is.
Instamatic. And it took film.
I'm going to Google it.
And I discovered very quickly that I could put slide film in. I'm not sure how I came across slide film, because my mum liked taking photos a lot. She always took, you know, snapshots and had them printed. And I discovered slide film, and that's all I ever used after that. I loved slide film. And I remember we went to a ruined stately home, and I remember climbing around in the ruins when I was about 16 with this little Instamatic taking photos. And I loved it. I mean, I really loved it. Then my parents bought me a Praktika. It was a sort of East German 35mm camera.
Nice. Do you still have these cameras by any chance?
No, the Praktika was stolen when I was in America. Oh. And so we bought something else, which I later gave away to somebody. And then eventually I ended up with a Rolleiflex, which I haven't taken to Tibet, and I got a Nikon. Because I decided to go to art college rather late in the day. I did a degree at a university at first, but I somehow felt I should have always gone to art school. So I managed to get a place at art school to do an MA. And the project that I proposed to them was photographic.
Yeah.
And to my astonishment, they said, yeah, all right. So I needed a good camera. My family clubbed together and gave me 150 quid. And my friend in London, her husband, had a part interest in a camera shop. And he said, give me the 150 quid and I'll get you a really good second-hand camera. And that's how I ended up with a really nice Nikon with a 50mm lens.
Very nice.
It was a lovely camera, very, very light compared to digital cameras. And because of slide film, a film generally, you have to be much more skillful, actually, with film cameras. So I learned about different speeds of film in different settings. But I had no training. I was completely figuring it out on my own.
Right. So then you have this camera, you've done your master's, and then essentially this book is the combination of your passion for the Tibetan nomads and your love of photography. So did you always go to Tibet with the expectation or the intent to photograph it?
Yeah. when I finally went, which wasn't till 2000, and I was very lucky, I got funding. I was incredibly fortunate because it's really expensive, and I've always lived rather close to the edge financially in order to have kind of artistic freedom, I suppose.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So you essentially paid to go over there and document it and take pictures.
Yeah, so I've been going on and off since 2000.
Is your book a combination of everything since 2000?
Yeah, it's a mixture, yeah. It's really portraits. It's focusing on portraits of people I met. So the early portraits in the book were taken with film.
Yeah.
And then the later ones were when I got a digital camera.
I'm just scrolling through the photos there. Incredible. Do all these people like having their photos taken then?
Yeah, if they don't like it, I won't take their photos.
So they're very welcoming to like cameras and things like that.
Yeah, I'm very fortunate. They've been amazing. Really amazing. If they don't want it, they'll let you know. Or they'll walk away.
Yeah.
And of course, when I was with Nomads, I was staying with them. They knew what I was doing. So they were wonderfully relaxed, but they work so hard as well. I don't think they had time to kind of feel sort of self-conscious or anything like that.
Yeah, there's some beautiful pages in here, beautiful pictures.
Thank you.
How do you kind of approach your photography then, especially in portraits? Do you have like a style, would you say? Do you have a composition that you like? How do you go about it?
I don't think I think of anything like that. It's completely instinctive. I mean, I studied art history at university, so it's sort of in there somewhere.
Yeah.
But there isn't a conscious thing about, ooh, I'm going to do it like this. I just sort of watch and look and see what I find compelling, and then I don't think about it. If I thought about it, I wouldn't be able to do it.
Very true. You can't overthink it.
You can't. It won't work. It won't work.
So could you possibly give me some more background on like the nomadic families you stayed with? What was like the family setup? Was everyone living together?
Mostly my experience has been of younger people with children. Might be the families that we came across. The older people, when I say older people, I mean the sort of elders, often seem to live more in the winter quarters because it's a little bit more comfortable for them. Because since the last 12 or 15 years, they've been encouraged by the government to build winter quarters of varying degrees of sophistication. And often the older people will live in those all year round. Not always, but more and more these days they do that. Traditionally, they all would have been together, moving around together, the whole family. And the children help with all the tasks. You know, they help collect the animals for milking, and they often go and look after them. You know, they watch them when they go off to the pastures. So the whole family gets involved, but it's changing a lot because they're being encouraged to send children to school.
Yeah.
So in fact, that's changing the dynamic in nomad camps in more recent years because the adults are finding it harder to get all the jobs done. And what I've witnessed quite often is men doing jobs that traditionally were done by women. So there's a kind of levelling up going on in terms of what this, you know, the division between the sexes.
Yeah, so even their society is like evolving as well.
It's evolving, yeah.
Very interesting.
Yeah, I haven't very often seen men milking or collecting dung, but I have seen it. It's happening more and more.
Yeah. So one thing I noticed is the foreword in the book and who it's written by. Can you possibly tell me a bit about how that came about and who's the writer of the foreword?
Oh, yes. Jetsunma Tenzin Palmo is a wonderful person. She's I've been friends with her for many years, and I often go and stay in her nunnery. And she's a British lady who decided that she must be a Buddhist when she was about 18, I think, working in a library in London. She grew up in the East End.
Mm.
And she found her way eventually to India to volunteer with a lady called Kiran Bedi, who became a disciple of the very Karmapa that I met in England. So there are all these kind of links. And Kiran Bedi became a nun, and she introduced Tenzin Palmo to a very high lama called Kamtrul Rinpoche. And Tenzin Palmo decided very quickly that she wanted to become a nun. Uh-huh. And the Kamtrul Rinpoche asked her, he sent her off to do many retreats. And she lived in a cave for about 12 years in Lahul in India. And then she was asked to set up a nunnery in India. So she managed to get a lot of support, and that's what she's done. So she's very remarkable. I think we got on very quickly because we both loved Italian art.
Hmm.
So Italian Renaissance art, we have that in common, and Mozart. So she's very, artistically and creatively aware. And she's very funny. She's got a great, very British sense of humour. She's a terrific teacher. Very down to earth, very direct Buddhist teacher.
Fascinating. Did you ask her to do the foreword, or did she want to do it?
I asked her if she'd consider it, and she said, oh, yes. So she did. I didn't tell her what to write. I didn't bribe her or anything.
I mean, yeah, she's written some nice things.
I know. I'll slip her a fiver later.
So does she reside in India now then?
Yes, she has for years and years, yeah.
Does she come back every now and then?
Occasionally she comes to England, yeah, and gives teachings here, yes.
Wow.
Yeah, she does. She stayed in my house. She gave teachings locally in Worcester.
Hmm.
And I was very honoured to host her here.
Wow. Throughout the book, there are these little paragraphs from people. Tell us a bit about that.
There are lots of different, some of them are songs, some are quotes from people I've met, some are from the Buddha and various great Tibetan sages.
Yes, I can really tell when the photo is kind of like shift to digital.
Yes, that's why I gripped them in the way I did. I thought it made it sort of would flow more easily. I thought because it is very, very different working with film. That's my experience. I don't know, other photographers may not feel like that, but film, you have to really, I mean, I can't pretend I was that skilled. I had no training. I just did what I could. I wasted an enormous amount of film because you can't adjust things as you can with digital.
Yeah.
And I wasn't a film darkroom photographer. You know, I had to send my films away to be processed by a lab. And then when I had exhibitions, I would send them to a master printer who worked with Cibachrome, because slide film, the old process of printing slide film was directly onto Cibachrome using the slide like a negative.
Yeah.
And one of the reasons I moved to digital reluctantly was because I realized that I would have to scan all the transparencies and it's so expensive. I didn't feel it was something I would do justice to, trying to do it myself. So I thought, okay, it's time to grasp the new technology.
Yeah. Were these pictures are these raw, or are they kind of like edited?
There's a certain amount of editing, yeah. Because also, especially because with digital, you have that possibility. In fact, raw digital photos tend, in my experience, look very flat.
Yeah,
I know a lot of people don't like them. A lot of photographers don't like them.
I'm just admiring the picture on page 57.
Oh, is that Wangdrak Rinpoche?
Yes, it is.
Yeah, yeah, he's a great friend of mine. He's also a friend of Tenzin Palmer as well.
Wow. So how do they just cook on the clay stove all the time?
Yes.
Is it like a big barbecue then?
I don't know. To be honest, I don't use barbecues. I haven't got one. They're very subtle. They have different places. So they've got a very hot spot.
Yeah.
Although they vary. These stoves vary from region to region and tent to tent. Some of them are extremely simple, but a lot of them are very long and they're different parts of the stove. It's a little bit like an arga. You know, there's the hottest space and then you can move your kettle back to a not so hot place and it goes like that.
Yeah.
And you can, underneath, you can often have a little place where you can put your shoes to dry off. They're beautiful. I really, really love the Nomad's clay stoves, but many of the Nomads have moved over to metal stoves now, which is a shame because the clay stoves hold the heat better.
Do they kind of make the clay stoves when they set up camp, essentially?
Yeah, so when they move camp, they leave it to biodegrade back into the ground.
Yeah.
And then the following year, when they come back to the same place, they don't put the tent in the same spot. They allow that piece of land to rest for quite a long time. So they generally will put the tent somewhere else and make the stove again wherever they go. They make it every time they move. And they probably, that's why some of them probably like metal stoves, because they think, oh, I don't want to. I have to keep making the stove. I haven't got so many helpers around now. So
yeah, interesting.
Yeah, but actually, I prefer the clay stoves. They're much warmer. You don't have to keep feeding them so often. They hold. Hmm. They really retain the heat, and they're sort of, some of them are so beautiful to look at. They're like they're so sculptural.
It looks like it takes, firstly, a lot of knowledge to make that and a lot of hard work. And I like the idea of being able to cook on something you've built. I think that's quite special.
Yeah.
And obviously not many people do that these days, but the idea that people still do is really nice.
Yeah, I mean, I have a friend called Jeltso, and that's his speciality. He's a settled nomad, and he goes and makes these magnificent stoves for other nomads who, often young ones. I think he's kind of teaching them the skill. Because some of the young nomads actually want to go back to a more traditional thing. So Jeltso's their man, really.
Nice. With all of these pictures you took over the years since your first trip, I imagine you had a lot of photos.
Yes.
So how did you kind of go about compiling them and picking which ones you wanted to include in this book?
Oh, God, it was poor Peter. He helped me. I mean, he was remarkable. He was so patient and helpful. And we went through thousands of them.
How many roughly do you reckon you looked at for this book?
Oh, crikey, I don't even know. I mean, it's too frightening to even come up with a figure. I've got so many. I could probably tell you by looking at Lightroom how many photos I've got stored. It's difficult to work. I can see how many I've got on there, but of course not all of them are pictures of Tibet. 18,750 photos.
Oh, wow.
And
so probably just over 10,000.
Yeah, so you're probably right. I don't know that, I'm not entirely sure that I subjected Peter to the entire 10,000. But it was very, very helpful of him. So, in other words, he ended up with the photos that he liked.
Yeah. Were there any that you really liked that didn't make it?
Oh, gosh, yeah, loads. But sometimes I petitioned for some to be included. Some we swapped some. But also, there were so many, there was plenty of room for another book. Yeah, because there were some people that I kept photographing over and over again because I was quite compelled by them.
Hmm.
There's one family who live in Dahu Valley, Sunan Wongbo and his wife, Pema. And I found Pema very compelling because she loves her children so much. And just the way she would look at her children, even while she was milking a Drew, and then she'd look at it. So I've got an awful lot of Pema.
Nice.
And of Sunan Wongbo, because he's very photogenic. And I just liked him. He's just a nice guy.
So what do you hope readers can gain through this book then, through engaging with these images and the people they capture?
I really hope they fall in love with the culture like I did and are inspired by it. I mean, we can't go back to living that sort of life, but I hope it helps people value the people who still do live this extraordinary way of life. So that's my big hope. I really wanted to touch people's hearts.
Yeah.
Anywhere in the world, wherever it goes. I really hope it goes wide, not anything to do with me and money or name or fame, but I really love these people and I want to, it's kind of a love letter to them, really.
Yeah.
To nomad life in Tibet. And the beauty and the simplicity of their culture, we could really learn a lot from that. I could. I've got way too, you can see, I've got way too much stuff for starters. And I think some of them have left nomad life and they regret it. It's very interesting. Wangdrat Rinpoche was telling me that a lot of them have begun to see through embracing kind of globalization and all the sort of things that drive us, you know, time and money. And he said there's a sort of, they're looking back with nostalgia and there's a move to return to some of the aspects of the nomad way of life from those who've settled.
Very nice. I think that's a brilliant note to end on. And it certainly sparked a fascination in me with regard to Tibet nomads, and I'm definitely going to, you know, learn a lot more about this with a few Googles here and there after this episode, because it's really fascinating hearing about your experience and the making of this book. You know, it has really sparked fascination in the kind of people that you've captured.
Oh,
so I suppose the kind of last question for you is, what's next? Are there any other kind of people you're kind of fascinated to take photos of?
Well, the next book with Grafeg is actually, again, about nomads, but it's more, this first one is portraits, and the second one is really about going into more detail about their way of life. So really showing daily life, you know, a whole chapter on daily life or pilgrimage and things like that.
Yeah.
And then the other group of people that I have a real fascination for are the Gadi shepherds in Himachal in India. And they are also kind of nomadic. I suppose it's, you'd call it transhumance, I think, what they practice. They come up from the plains of southern Himachal or northern Punjab and they go up into the Himalaya, as the Indians would say. They go up into the mountains. In the spring, they start going up and they live without tents.
Wow.
Extraordinary. But I know a lot of people in one little Gadi village in India, and I'd quite like just to do something about that one village because I think I'm too old now to go chasing up and down mountains. I've just had it, really. A bit long in the tooth.
You can just stay in the village and just focus.
I spend a lot of time in that village when I go to India, and I'm very fond of the people there.
Wow, very
fond
nice.
Of them.
Well, I look forward to the next couple of books then, and the people you kind of investigate a bit more. And I'm fascinated to learn more of the history behind it.
Thank you. There's not a lot on offer, which is, I'm sort of filling a gap, I think.
Yeah. It's been a pleasure to talk to you and absolutely fascinated to hear about your experience, you know, with the Tibetan nomads and your travels and creating this book. So thank you very much for coming on the podcast. And hopefully when the next book comes out, you'll be back on for another episode.
Okay. Thank you, Kieran. Thank you.
Thank you very much for talking to me. Have a great day.
Thanks.
Massive thank you for Diane Barker for coming on today's episode to talk all about her experiences in Tibet with Tibetan nomads and the experience of photographing them and creating this wonderful book, Portraits of Tibet. Copies of the book can be picked up at graphic.com or all good local bookshops. Thank you for listening to this episode of Meet the Author podcast, brought to you by Graphic Publishing, presented and produced by me, Kieran Minetta-Jones. If you enjoyed this podcast, please share it around and give it a review so other people can find out the fascinating stories from the people behind the books.